Okay. So, I do have handouts. Just to usually pass the back, that'd be great. Right, thank you very much for having me. So, this is it's something Tobin and I have been working on for a while now. He apologises that he can't be here. And when I sort of realised about a week ago that I was presenting, it's a rather hastily cobbled together presentation. So please excuse me if I'm relying on my notes slightly more than I normally would. Essentially, what Coben and I have been looking at is imperatives and how imperatives get used in interaction. We compiled a data corpus drawing on about 13 hours of US and UK English-speaking interactions. About 9 hours are from adult interactions, and then just shy of 4 hours is adult-child interactions. And we identified a broad collection of 650 imperatives within that. For this analysis, we focused our analysis on examples in the collection in which an imperative formulation performed the action of a directive. By that we mean they made observable compliance, as opposed to non-observable compliance, like imagine, immediately relevant in the next action, rather than in some future action. And so we're referring to our narrow collection as imperative directives. There's a rich existing literature that addresses the use of imperatives as directives in interaction. In these publications, imperatives are often contrasted with other request formulations, most notably modals. And some of the relevant considerations to bear in mind when studying imperatives seem to be issues of entitlement, contingency, rights, responsibilities, deontic asymmetries, and how they influence the choice of request formulation. The issue of the relationship between grammar and action, and the extent to which there probably isn't a one-to-one mapping of the form of an utterance, imperative, to the function of the utterance, directive. There's also important to bear in mind the coordination between embodied and verbal actions. Particularly seems to be relevant when we're dealing with adult-child interaction, but no doubt is important in other situations as well. And finally, there's been a line of work suggesting that the choice to use an imperative is particularly hinges on whether or not there has been some prior commitment to the course of action, or whether it's a course of action that's considered jointly owned between the participants in the interaction. So there are some broad considerations that we need to have when we're looking at the imperatives. For our analysis, we started with our 650 imperatives, narrowed those down to about 265 imperative directives. And a common feature of our imperative directives was this intuitive sense that they were admonishing the recipient for some failure of their conduct regarding the directed action. We intuitively coded our imperative directives, and about 40% of them came out as either strongly admonishing or admonishing, with the rest either being not admonishing or not sure. So it's not an insignificant proportion of this the imperative directives were doing something admonishing-y. And so then the task for our analysis became, how do we come up with a technical understanding of how the action of admonishing becomes visible to participants and therefore becomes interaction relevant? Or essentially, how do we recognise when we're being told off? Several researchers have glossed the central action of an imperative directive as being an attempt to get someone to do something. It's well established that imperative directives are closely involved in the initiation and the progression of courses of action. In our data, we've observed three points of contact between non-admonishing imperative directives and the progressivity of a course of action. Namely, an imperative can initiate, progress, or expedite a course of action. They can kick things off, they can move the action from one step to another in a broader course of action, or they can help facilitate and expedite smooth progressivity of it. This isn't a new observation, but it's important for our analysis to first consider the relationship of imperative directives to the progressivity of a course of action, so that we can then contrast it with imperative admonishments. So let's take a quick look at what I'm calling the imperative directive. Imperatives can initiate a course of action. Here, Wesley issues the imperative for Mum to pass the tea, please. There's no indication in the interaction prior to line 7 that Wesley might be seeking to have the tea passed to him. As an action, Mum passing the tea to him only becomes relevant once Wesley has issued the directive. So for imperative directives, the relevance of the directed action is contingent upon the directive itself. The action is introduced and made relevant by the directive in the moment it's delivered. Which brings us to the general gloss that we've come up with for imperative directives, that non-admonishing imperative directives work to initiate, progress, or expedite a course of action in which the specific directed action is only made relevant as a next action by the directive itself. And although I'm not going to go through them today, we have got examples in our collection of this progressing or expediting a course of action where the same thing holds true. The specific action that's being directed only becomes relevant as the directive is issued. Today I want to focus on the examples in our collection where the imperative is not only telling the recipient what to do, it also tells them off for not having done it already. And what I'm going to suggest is that they can be distinguished from imperative directives on the basis of whether or not the directed action was projectably relevant prior to the imperative being issued. Luke and Rick are playing a game of Monopoly. Luke has tried to tell a story quite a few times. Here's his first attempt at telling a story.
Well, I got a story to tell you.
Now, let's go, let's just get the rules.
And so that gets deferred by Rick. A bit later on, he tries again.
So, I almost spilled someone today.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
No,
this is
terrible.
Seriously?
Alright, explain that.
Alright, well, after my boom community chest.
He makes, in total, 6 different attempts to tell this story until we get to the extract that I'm going to focus on today.
He shoots. Alright.
Alright, tell me the goddamn story.
Okay.
Before you roll, because
before I roll.
We can't tell a story.
Because you know how I roll. Hold on, let me get a little
sip,
slash gulp, slash chug, slash.
Okay, so our target line here is, tell me the goddamn story. I'm hoping it's intuitively obvious to people that this is, firstly, an imperative, and secondly, not just straightforwardly telling him to do something. There's this sense of admonishing him for not already having done it. So, Rick issues the imperative, directs Luke to tell the story, also admonishes him for not having already done it. Here, the course of action, telling a story, was already in progress, so it was both projectable and contingently relevant as a possible next action. At each point, there's a break in the game, which there is here. We've got the all right boundary marker. We're ready for something new to happen, and telling a story is relevant in this context. The action of telling a story has stalled prior to completion on numerous occasions. Stuff has got in the way. So the imperative admonishment restores the progressivity of telling a story. The key point to note here is how the action of the imperative is different to what it was in the Virginia extract with regards to projectability and relevance of the directed action. This example also has some additional lexical cues to help us identify the imperative as admonishing. We've got the use of goddamn with sort of a stance of frustration towards the action. And Rick then goes on to specify that Luke's story should be told before you roll, which makes explicit that story should be told before engaging in some other game-related activity. And it also highlights the fact that the game has contributed to the delay in telling Luke's story. We can't tell a story as we're playing. The other examples in our collection don't have such obvious admonishing markers. So our task is to describe how they nevertheless come to be understood as admonishments. At this point, it's important to distinguish between a technical understanding of admonishing that we're describing here from a more vernacular understanding. Some examples that we're going to present are more or less admonishing. But what we hope to argue is that the grounds on which they can be treated as admonishing lies in the extent to which they hold the recipient to account for the lack of progressivity of a projectable and relevant action. So in a technical sense, Admonishments can be understood as imperatives that progress a course of action that has stalled in some way prior to completion. Now, there are many different ways in which an ongoing action might have stalled. We've found quite a few in our collection, and I've got a couple of different ways to show you today, but we suspect it's probably an open set of ways in which an action can stall, that the admonishment then acts upon them to restore the progress of it. One of the ways is through admonishing a lack of response. So a recognisable first pair part of an adjacency pair establishes a socially normative obligation for the recipient to provide a second pair part. The withholding of a second pair part disrupts the progressivity and can provide a warrant for an imperative to restore the progressivity. Mum asks Dad to pull Lucy's chair in on line 3 using the modal request formulation. Dad doesn't respond. Mum reissues her request, this time upgraded to the imperative formulation, akin to the pattern Craven and Potter described. The imperative calls Dad to account for failing to respond to Mum's earlier request. By line 5, the action of pulling Lucy's chair in is projectable, relevant, and crucially missing. Dad's missed the opportunity to pull the chair in. In response to the imperative admonishment, Dad complies with the directive and pulls Lucy's chair in. Although this example is less obviously admonishing than the Monopoly one, the core action is the same. It captures the difference between telling someone to perform a newly relevant action, imperative directive, or telling someone to do something whilst holding them to account for not already having done it, imperative admonishment. As another example, an example of displacement for you. So a projectively relevant action can be displaced from its relevant position by another action. This extract occurs as all the participants have finished serving the food. Emily's asked what let's enjoy is in French. She answers bon appétit. She gets praised for the correct answer. And then she starts repeating bon appétit in a sort of lyrical way. Your transcript starts at the third post-praise repeat of bon appétit.
Okay, what's that in French?
Bon appétit.
What's that?
So, at the start of the extract, serving the food's been completed, and eating is a projectively relevant next action for Emily. The relevance of the action is provided by the overall structural organisation of a meal, but it's also invoked locally in that every other member of the family has started eating at this point. On line 8, Emily starts to add movements to her lyrical bon appétit. It appears she's attempting to engage the rest of the family in a shared singing activity. We've got repetition, we've got the comments that their absence has been noted, just me, and then the gesture leaning towards her parents in turn on lines 8 and 13. Mum interrupts Emily with the imperative eat on line 11. It both directs Emily to eat her food and admonishes her for delaying the start of the meal with an activity other than that which was projected by the local context. Mum repeats the imperative during Emily's next bon appétit, when here she's attempting to solicit Dad to join her game. So what I'm trying to show here is that by displacing an action, Emily has displaced the action of eating a meal out of the point at which it was relevant by the singing activity. The imperative admonishment restores progressivity of the activity that had been displaced. Both displacement and withholding a second pair part are different ways that an action can become stalled, but in both cases, the imperative admonishment is restoring the progressivity. Another way in which an action can become stalled is if there is an observably incomplete state. It can be considered grounds for a course of action being treated as stalled and therefore provide a warrant for an imperative admonishment, which is what happens here.
It's up campus as well. Six till eight thirty.
Yeah,
are you cold?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but...
that or on the back of my thing.
This one is on.
So, at the start of the extract, Kate begins to put her arms through her coat sleeves, but then halts the course of action while her coat is half on. Fabio questions whether Kate is cold. Kate confirms this is the correct diagnosis of her problem. At this point, it's clear that Kate has begun a course of action that's designed to remedy the problem of being cold, namely putting her coat on. But she's failed to complete the action and has come to rest in an observably incomplete state, coat half on. Fabio then issues the imperative, cover yourself up properly, in an attempt to restore the forward movement towards completion of the action. So once again, we've got a projectively relevant course of action that's stalled prior to completion, and the imperative is used to direct the recipient to complete the stalled course of action, to restore progressivity. In our collection, we systematically excluded prohibitives. Don't stand, don't wander around the room, don't steal my potato. In so doing, we excluded the majority of prohibitions, telling someone not to do something. But a minority of prohibitions are implemented through the imperative grammar, and therefore these remained in our collection. We termed these positive prohibitions, and we think they merit some specific discussion here. So in this particular extract, the family are discussing different types of potato that the children like. Jessica declares she likes the mashed potato that Dad has on his plate, and she leans over to take some. Whereupon Dad delivers the imperative, leave, 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 please.
We like that. We like that.
We do.
We like chips.
So, Jessica announces that she likes that. Her indexical referent is specified by pointing towards the mashed potato on Dad's plate. She then retracts her arm, ending the point. But then she leans over again, this time initiating a course of action to take some of Dad's mashed potato. At the point when Jessica is reaching towards Dad's plate, he's already in the process of preparing a forkful of food to eat himself. So Jessica's initiating action, taking his mash, would prevent him from completing the course of action he's already engaged in, eating his own food. As Jessica reaches his potato, Dad issues the imperative, leave, 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 please, with the repetition and the please sort of umphing up the insistence and the force that she really does need to leave his potato alone. The imperative does ostensibly direct Jessica to do something, leave. But in actual fact, the action here is to disengage her from her current action, rather to engage her in something she wasn't doing. That's why we're saying it's a positive prohibition rather than an imperative admonishment. The positive prohibition is an admonishment that embodies a claim that the recipient could have not and should have not performed the prohibited action. The relevance of the directed action, leave, lies in the irrelevance of the prohibited action, stealing Dad's potato, for the progressivity of the activity, for the progressivity of the course of action that was already in progress, Dad eating his potato. The warrant for the admonishment lies in the disruption of the progressivity of Dad eating his potato and the attempt to restore that progressivity. Once Jessica has moved her arm back, Dad is able to finish building his forkful and take a bite of food. Interestingly, after he's completed his course of action, he does then offer Jessica some food, and then she gets some. But he finished the course of action he was engaged in first. So unlike the examples before, to leave something doesn't initiate a new course of action, imperative directive, or straightforwardly restore forward progressivity, like an admonishment. Instead, it requires the recipient to undo something they've just done in order to permit progressivity to be restored. So essentially, a course of action is set in motion that establishes the projectable relevance of completion, eating one's mashed potato. An action is initiated that obstructs that course of action, that obstructs the progressivity of the course of action, taking Dad's mashed potato. The obstruction of the course of action provides a local warrant for the imperative admonishment. The directed action requires the prohibited action to be undone in order to restore the progressivity of the original course of action. And what all of that leads to is three types of imperatives that are trying to get someone to do something that differ in terms of how they relate to the opportunity that existed for the directed action to be performed, the projectable relevance of the directed action, and crucially, they differ in terms of how they relate to the progressivity of the course of action. So imperative directives are issued at a point at which the recipient couldn't have performed the directed action prior to the imperative. There was no opportunity for them to have done it. Therefore, the directed action wasn't projectable as a relevant next action. And in terms of progressivity, the imperative is initiating, progressing, or expediting progressivity. In contrast, for the imperative admonishment, there was an opportunity for the recipient to have performed the directed action, and they missed it. They could have performed it, but they didn't. They also should have performed it because it was projectable and relevant. So in this case, the admonishment is restoring stored progressivity. The case of the positive prohibition is slightly different because they took an opportunity that the person issuing the imperative wishes they hadn't. So we're sort of saying the recipient could have not performed the prohibited action, and the recipient should have not performed the prohibited action. But in both cases, be it the imperative admonishment or the positive prohibition, the action of the imperative is to restore the stalled progressivity. And that's the basis on which we're saying they can be understood as admonishing rather than simply directing. Normative expectations exist around how courses of action should proceed. For example, we know what a complete putting one's coat on action should look like. You put your sleeves in, you shrug it over your shoulders, you do it in front of you. We know how long it's supposed to take and broadly what's involved in doing it. The same is also true for more complicated and more collaborative social actions, telling a story, sympathy, all that kind of thing. A normative metric of progressivity underpins the sequential organisation of interaction. Imperatives are a resource that's available to us for managing the progressivity of our interlocutors' actions. Imperatives can straightforwardly initiate, progress, or expedite a course of action, as in the case of the imperative directive. But imperatives also draw attention to moments when a course of action is failing to progress according to normative expectations, starting to eat a meal at the appropriate time. When things are expected to be done at a particular place in the interaction and they're not done, there's a breach of the normal progressivity of the action. And imperatives are one tool for retrospectively marking the breach and enforcing the social norms of progressivity by restoring the forward momentum of the action. The timing of the imperative relative to the progressivity of the action is sufficient to indicate whether it straightforwardly directs the action of the recipient or simultaneously directs and admonishes them. The admonishing element can be enhanced and made more explicit through various prosodic and lexical cues, but if you tell someone to do an action that could have already been relevantly performed, your directive will be potentially hearable as an admonishment purely by virtue of its relationship to progressivity. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, good. Questions, comments, observations? Andrew Morrison.
Quick one. You said that you were excluding all the ordinary negative prohibitives.
Yes.
I can't remember. Did you say why?
Essentially, it was to try and get us down to... We were trying to find
a manageable set.
Directives. We actually thought we'd excluded all prohibitions by getting rid of the don't do this and don't do that.
Oh, okay.
And it was only when we then came up against examples like leave, 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 please, we're like, well, why is this different to what we're doing? So we thought we'd got rid of all of them, and then we had to explain why some were still in there.
To get purer directives.
Yeah.
Right, okay, thanks.
Alexa?
Lovely data, lovely talk again. It's just so wonderful. I'm wondering about the boundaries of the action of admonishing within your overall data set. So I was wondering about the goddamn, tell the goddamn story and the coat example
mm-hmm.
specifically, in the sense that it's kind of in their, he wanted to tell a story and she wanted to put, you know, she was cold, she went, I don't know, it's just that there's something about it being in their, very much in their interests
yeah.
as a course of action that makes it sound not so admonishing, I suppose.
Yeah.
So, like, where you draw the line between what you're hearing as admonishing. I mean, I don't know if they would have felt admonished in that situation.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely something that we did toy with, because we spent, that's why we had this sort of lane coding system, or sort of going around, is that admonishing, is it not admonishing?
Mm.
And we sort of started from an intuitive sense.
Mm.
And it was only when we were then going through and actually trying to really map the order in which things were happening that certain things got included and excluded. We do have some interesting examples of people pleading for someone to do something and also gloating at someone else's misfortune, both of which are done through the imperatives in this case, which is how they ended up in our collection. But they do seem to be slightly different.
Mm.
So yeah, I guess we were sort of, the analysis is more focused on distinguishing between a pure directive and a directive that has the potential to be admonishing.
Let's take two questions at once, Ruth and Elliot, and then we'll then Alexander can answer both. So
okay.
Ruth and
I wondered whether you had any imperatives done at the same time as the actions being done by other. So I know in my own and some colleagues' medical data, you get this curious thing where somebody's evidently, objectively, already doing the action, but you get the professional that is, I think in all the cases,
mm-hmm.
doing an imperative, and I wondered whether you've got any of those.
You touched on this briefly, you said that you sometimes these things in that position are hearable as gloating or pleading, but I just wanted to hear more about that. So is that position privileged for anything you say there is in the first case hearable as an admonishment, or is it also possible that without it being projectable, you can get something that sounds like acknowledgement without that course of action already having been set in place before that.
Okay, to take yours, Ruth, yes, we've got some nice examples of that too, and it was only when we really, really sort of looked at incredibly ridiculous, like really slow video moving. We've got one example from the Monopoly set where one of the characters has just picked up all of the pieces. So he's just started the action of picking up the unused playing counters and putting them back in the box. And he clasps his hand around them, and he's just got his hand around all of them when the other player says, put that on this thing. So he hasn't yet started the reaching to put them away, but he has done the picking up part of it.
Mm.
So it's possibly an issue in terms of how granular you are when you're defining actions or courses of actions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the example we've got of expediting a course of action. Telling him where to put them at that moment isn't admonishing him for not having done it, because he hadn't started, but he'd done the step before it, the picking up the counters before you put them in.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it was a very, very fine line between, are you saying something that sort of does it just as they start it, or does it moving on to the next step?
Mm-hmm.
Because we've got examples of a mother helping a child get ready for bed, and there's clearly a series of steps that they go through. And at various points, mum sort of says, right, bend over and touch your toes, and it's the next thing that needs to happen. And the child knows that it's the next thing that needs to happen, but there were other things that could have happened, so it's not a missed opportunity. Sorry, I'm not explaining that very clearly, am I?
No, yes, you are. It's just different to the ones that I'm thinking of. And I suppose that I've never looked closely at them enough, but they're curious, but they seem to be doing the work of... Well, if we're being really crude about it, it's maintaining my authority and telling you what to do. But I know that's too crude, and I was just interested whether you could see any of that going on. You know, who's in authority here over what is being done?
Yeah.
Issues are going on, I think, in doing imperatives at that point.
I think
who's really initiated it?
We might just leave that. But
sorry. yes, Elliot. In all honesty, the gloating and the pleading ones confuse me slightly. So I wish Cobian was here to field that particular question. But the sense that we've got from the data is the vast majority of the ones that we've got, you could code for
directing or directing and admonishing. It was odd cases that did something else. And in all of the examples that we've looked at, like the pleading one, it was whereas Rick was admonishing Luke for not having told the story when he should have done, the pleading one is someone then admonishing, then pleading. Hang on, how does it work? So we've got the example I showed is when Rick admonishes Luke for not telling a story, but we've also got an example of when a group of people are pleading with someone to tell them the story. I think it might rest in the prosody and lexicus and sort of more specific things like that that distinguish it from admonishing, because we did initially have it in as admonishing and then we're like, hang on, there's other stuff going on here. Sorry, that's not particularly clear.
As we take the last question, Alison, you might come up and just do the handover and just prepare the PC. Yes, Kath.
Could you just clarify the difference between progressing or expediting versus something that is stored? Because it seems to me that, you know, can you pull in the chair, pull in the chair? Because you might equally call that just progressing or expediting the pulling in of the chair.
So
how is that?
Yes, the reason we're distinguishing it is as soon as Mum said, can you pull the chair in, pulling the chair in became a relevant action.
Yeah.
So at the point at which the imperative was issued, Dad had missed an opportunity to do it. So and it's exactly the same action. Pull the chair in, told you to do it, you haven't done it. Now I'm using the imperative to admonish you for not having done it. With the progressing a course of action, we're using that to describe courses of action that, as a lot do, have lots of discrete steps. And the imperative is issued just as you're coming to the end of one step, but before you've started the next step. And the imperative directs you to start that next step. So you haven't missed the opportunity to start the next step. It's just directing you to do it before you get there. Similarly with the expediting one, it sort of foresees a potential problem. Like, he's picked them up, but he doesn't know where to put them, and then directs you where to put them before you get to that stage.
I think there would be a lot more questions, but I think we'd better move on. So thank you once again, Howard.